Morning, please be seated. All right, we're here for oral argument this morning in our case number CV25-0653, High Desert versus CEC. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if desired. Please keep in mind that we've read the briefs and have conferenced the case this morning. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jordan Wolf on behalf of Appellant CEC 14120761 LLC. I'd like to try to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. You know, this injunction cannot stand for two independent reasons, and the court need only reach one. First, it is void because CEC never received constitutionally adequate notice. High Desert only served a previously suspended lawyer, which it knew was no longer in function as counsel, and second, independently because it exceeds the court's statutory authority because it permanently bars CEC from asserting rights which the February 2023 judgment expressly preserved. So I'd like to begin with the notice, but want to flag from the outset the scope of the problem is independent. Even if the court has no concerns about service, the injunction reaches a conduct of the judgment never was adjudicated, and that alone requires reversal. Now, when High Desert filed its petition initially in February 2024, it sought a permanent injunction. And this was post-judgment pleading seeking new relief. And Rule 5C4 requires a service that way the summons be served under Rule 4. Whether on CEC or statutory agent, High Desert did neither. It only served Mark Goldman. And this is where this case, I believe, is very interesting in the situation because prior to February 2024, I believe in the fall of 2023, Mark Goldman had been suspended from practicing law for 30 days. And that's important because under Rule 72, Supreme Court Rule 72, there's only two options. He had the ability to associate with counsel with written consent from his client, which didn't happen, or he had to withdraw. Apparently from the record, he did neither. But High Desert wants to take position that still meant that he was counsel of record. And that to me completely defeats the rule of 72. You can't be required to withdraw or associate with counsel, but still remain attorney of record just because that attorney didn't follow Supreme Court Rule 72. And also to the fact here, what adds another level to this is that High Desert's counsel at the time had known that Mr. Goldman had been suspended from the practice of law. So he had noticed that he had been suspended, and under Rule 72, he no longer could be counsel. He could not practice law for 30 days in the state of Arizona. He could not represent CEC. He couldn't represent anyone. He couldn't be attorney of the record. And for him to maintain that, he would have had to re-engage his client and reappear in the case.
I mean, you might have a point if this all had been filed during the 30-day suspension, but by the time the documents were filed to obtain this injunction, that suspension no longer applied, right?
At the time the injunction was filed, the suspension had been over, correct?
Right.
But that also doesn't alleviate the rule under 72, because there's only two options, either associate with counsel or withdraw. So the fact—
But let's say he doesn't do either of those two things. The 30-day suspension ends. Maybe the bar might have issues with him for not withdrawing during those 30 days, but after the 30 days is over, he's perfectly permitted to represent clients again, right?
There's nothing prohibiting from representing clients if he's been fully reinstated by the bar, correct?
Right.
But he would have had to reappear in every
single— Get that? Yeah.
Well, I guess to the point of what is 72 if he has to withdraw? Isn't that an automatic termination of the representation? Either you have to get associate with counsel, or you have to withdraw.
Yeah, but what we care about is what High Desert knew at the time it was serving the papers. And what it knew is, yeah, maybe he was suspended before, but he's no longer suspended. and he's listed as counsel of record in the litigation.
And but to the point, if he knew he'd been suspended, then he knew that he would have had to withdraw from the case.
But he didn't.
But he did not withdraw from the case. Right. And so,
and in fact, I think wasn't there a new attorney, another attorney?
For the appeal aspect of the case, there was another attorney who entered appearance solely for the appeal, who was not served with these documents either. So it only comes down to what High Desert's counsel did at the time in February 2024, as far as its service.
So are you now arguing that another issue is that the counsel who was retained solely for the appeal wasn't served?
That's just a fact. It's just a side fact, not necessarily an argument. Here we're focused on whether the service on Mr. Goldman was sufficient. And that's what the briefing is about.
That was Mr. Abney.
Mr. Abney was the appellate attorney, correct.
Had Mr. Abney appeared in the Superior Court as counsel?
He made a notice of appearance only for the appeal.
Right. Okay.
And so, but it comes down to whether the briefing's been whether the service was effective on Mr. Goldman. And to the point, just because the rule requires you under Rule 72, like I said, the two options, he doesn't do any. Does that mean that Rule 72 just doesn't apply anymore? Because if he followed the rule correctly, he would have had to withdraw. Then he would have had to reappear.
I think you're making a good case for potentially a violation of Rule 72, which is a disciplinary action. I guess I'm not sure that's a matter for the state bar. We don't impose discipline here. So our question is more, I don't know, about the service, not about whether or not there was a Rule 72 violation.
But whether it's not a 72 violation is whether it reasonably calculated to be effective service on Mr. Goldman, knowing that Mr. Conan at the time knew that he had been previously suspended. And at that point in time, knowing the rules, hey, this...
He may have violated Rule 72 in failing to withdraw and then reinstate, but I guess I thought we clarified a few minutes ago that at the time of filing, of the operative filings, the suspension was no longer in effect. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, at the time that the initial petition was filed, I believe Mr. Goldman had been reinstated.
Okay.
After the suspension, so we're not seeing. I'm not seeing that at the time the petition happened, he was suspended. He was reinstated by that time, but it comes back to whether it's reasonably calculated. Should he have known that this was proper service on Mr. Goldman just because he was the attorney of record at the time, because that's what the docket said so? And it comes down to, he admits that he knew. If he didn't know that he was previously suspended, maybe a different argument. But the fact that he knew that he was suspended, that's what this comes down to, that he knew that he couldn't be counsel of record for that period of time. And it deflates what Rule 72 is. And yes, it may be a Supreme Court rule, but it's a rule attorneys have to follow. At that point, he couldn't be counsel of record unless he reinstated. I believe he would have had to reengage with his client, and he would have had to enter a new appearance into the case. That did not happen. And it comes to the point where Mr. Goldman just didn't answer the injunction, and it wasn't the point that they just previously finished briefing the appellate case, I think a few months ago, so it's not like CEC just gave up on the case. They're still on appeal, pushing their position, and then he just doesn't respond.
What do you mean re-engage?
What do you mean?
Mr. Goldman would have to draw up a new fee agreement?
I believe that, yeah, because when you're suspended, you can't practice law. You can't.
And then High Desert would have to, what, reach out to Mr. Goldman and say, Mr. Goldman, we know you were suspended. You haven't withdrawn. You need to withdraw. You need to draw up a new fee agreement with your client. And then you need to file a new notice of appearance so that we can serve you.
I don't think it's on HDA's counsel or any opposing counsel to tell another counsel, another attorney, hey, what they need to do with their client.
I guess, yeah, right, you're right. They don't need to tell him, but to serve Mr. Goldman, do they need to ask those questions? Like, we see you're still listed as counsel of record for CEC. We know you were suspended. Have you re-engaged with your client, and what does that look like?
Or to the extent, are you still counsel? Are you reappearing in this case? I think a clarification could go to the point of whether it was reasonably calculated that Mr. Goldman can receive service and whether he was authorized to receive service. Because once that suspension occurred, he's not authorized. He's not the agent of CEC. He can't do anything as counsel. And because the suspension ended within 30 days and he was reinstated, doesn't automatically make him return to anyone's counsel. I believe that at the suspension that the count that the term that the representation is terminated. And so it comes down to, was it reasonably calculated for HGH to serve Mr. Goldman and that to be effective service? And I believe the answer is no, because of the fact he knew that he had previously been suspended and took no efforts to ensure, hey, are you still in this case? Are you still representing CEC, whatever it may be? He just went and served him, didn't respond to emails, and ultimately an injunction got entered against CEC.
Counsel, I'd like to move on to the scope of the injunction and your arguments related to that. Can you clarify for me what precisely the original proceeding covered?
It had to do with an FTE action in which CEC was attempting to terminate the lease due to an assignment between the tenant and, I believe, a new company that may have purchased or whatever. It had to do with the assignment of the lease and whether it was a proper assignment under lease. And CEC ultimately tried to terminate the lease based on that assignment. And there's a lot, I think, counterclaims going back and forth. But that was ultimately the gist of trying to do an FDE action to take back the property for violation of the lease pursuant to that assignment clause.
But there was more to it than just the assignment clause.
There was more to it to what ultimately came down to things that were occurring during the time, but what was actually litigated was ultimately whether there was a breach of the lease due to that assignment clause. And the court ultimately said there wasn't a breach. The assignment was proper and essentially voided any other sort of notices that went out during that time. And that
it found there wasn't a breach by High Desert, but it found that CEC breached the lease, correct? By not approving the assignment.
Yes, that basically the assignment was proper.
So that was the only issue on appeal.
Yes,
in the original appeal.
That was the only issue on the appeal, was the assignment issue.
But it was a 4-day bench trial, so there was more litigated than just the assignment issue.
That is a long day just for an assignment, so I would tend to agree that there was a lot going on. There was also a lot of facts going on in this case at the time, but where the injunction went to the point of essentially expanding that judgment is basically prohibiting CEC from making any claims that necessarily weren't litigated, and ultimately made a raised judicata finding without any sort of additional litigation. It prohibited from bringing claims. Anything prior at the time was prior to the injunction, and then got dated back to the original judgment in 2023.
Under what subsection of Rule 60B does this argument fall? It's not part of the 60B3 argument, the fraud.
No, it's not about.
So it's either 4 or 6, right?
Correct.
4 is void. My understanding has always been void means the court didn't have subject matter or personal jurisdiction. I don't think this argument goes.
This argument, particularly,
those two things. So then I think you're in 6.
I think we're definitely in 6, but you know, obviously the 4 goes to the service issue with Mr. Goldman, which we discussed. But
right.
Yes. So, but the 6. Correct. And so the 6 goes to the point of.
So what is the scope of 6? Just anything the court thinks it did that it shouldn't have.
And it goes to the point of whether it's void. Did the court ultimately have the authority to expand this judgment? Could it put these restraints on CEC? Did it have the ability to do that?
Because there's no time deadline under 6, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I guess I have a hard time believing 6 is as broad as the court just thinks maybe it thinks it erred if party pops up 5 years after the judgment entered.
And
says this was overbroad.
And I guess there's always essentially a latch. You can't just sit on your rights forever. But this isn't a situation. It was, within the time that he learned about it in August, I believe it was in a few months that the Rule 60 motion was filed. So it wasn't that this was that someone just sat on his rights. It's when they found what was going on, I believe because High Desert wanted to file a motion for sanctions for violation of that injunction. And that's what started this whole situation.
Right. Under what subsection of 12-1801 did the court use to issue this injunction? There's 3, 1, 2, or 3.
And I believe
the injunction itself, I don't think, cites a particular
subsection. No, it got a little bit confusing because it was initially filed under an injunction against harassment, and then it got changed. And so it wasn't very clear on what the actual injunction, what the basis was of the injunction. But I think it's still to the point, can the court expand the judgment what expressly left open for CEC was basically any rights it had that wasn't a part of this matter. And that injunction foreclosed on that, saying that you cannot, and to the point, if there was a dispute between, hey, you can't, High Desert says, hey, you cannot, we resolved this issue already. Well, that's a court for the trial court to determine whether res judicata was this actually.
Did you dispute the court in the follow-on injunction that you're challenging in this appeal could include something that roughly equivalent to claim preclusion principles?
Yeah, it could, you're asking if they could, or is that you're saying what the issue is? Sorry, I missed the.
So I don't think you dispute that. For example, let's say CEC continue to serially file lawsuits about whether it breached the lease or not in withholding approval for the assignment. I think you'd say the court could enter an injunction saying stop filing claims when they've already been litigated.
I believe if he kept filing that same complaint, I believe there's a lot of avenues a court could have done sanctions under 12349, could have done many things, and also an injunction to stop him from filing the same complaint over and over again.
I think your argument is this goes well beyond claim preclusion principles.
Correct.
It goes, and issue preclusion.
I would agree, yes.
I mean, issue preclusion, the issues have to be actually litigated.
Correct. And here it stopped CEC from making any claims whatsoever prior, initially was the April 2024 date, then it got pushed back to the original February 2023. But it relieved them of any ability that they could do to essentially even talk about any issues that happened prior to that time.
I mean, the court had already included a claim preclusion provision in the original judgment, right?
So essentially that you...
It said HGH's request for permanent injunctive relief is granted to the following extent. CEC is permanently enjoined from contending and or acting as if the lease as amended had been terminated as a result of any issues decided in this action. The injunction does not foreclose CEC's rights under the lease as they pertain to any other matters.
Correct. Right. And so... But it stopped them. What the injunction did was stop them for any other matters, because there potentially were other matters prior to the injunction that were not resolved in that litigation. There's building code issues. There's things that occurred after the fact that.
Wasn't this judgment on appeal at the time that the court entered its follow-on judgment that you're challenging here?
Yeah, the mandate had not been entered in at the time. I think it was fully briefed at the time, right. But it was on appeal at the time.
Does the court even have jurisdiction to do that, to modify a judgment that's on appeal?
That's the point. That's the point, is that it was a modification of the judgment. And because it did modify, it wasn't a stay, it wasn't the status quo, it wasn't anything. It ultimately prohibited CEC from doing things that, or claiming things that the original judgment left open.
Did the court walk through the four requirements for obtaining injunctive relief under Arizona law?
Again, this was entered in without a hearing, without anything. It ultimately just entered, it just essentially rubber stamped the injunction as submitted. When no one responded to the actual application for injunction.
And the court did grant your relief, at least in part, right?
It did in part.
Was that under 60B6?
Yes, it was under the fact of not the date of the injunction, which is April 2024. It started back from the original judgment from February 2023.
So the court thought 60B6 applied at least in part.
Correct. And they also made it clear, because High Desert said that the attorney fees is not precluded under that as well. So they said, those two, for other reasons, it was Rule 60 was denied. Okay. And I would like to preserve as much time as I have here.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Frazier.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Eric Frazier on behalf of the plaintiffs, High Desert Healing. On the service issue, Your Honors, Rule 72 does not require withdrawals for a suspension of under 60 days. This suspension was long over, and a 30-day suspension at its core does not terminate the attorney-client relationship. It doesn't relieve the attorney of his duties to his client. It doesn't terminate those duties. And there does not need to be a new engagement or a new engagement letter. There does not need to be a new notice of appearance when there was no substitution of counsel during the suspension. I think what we heard here is a narrower version of what was in the briefs, so I don't want to dwell on exactly what High Desert knew and didn't know. The only thing that High Desert knew at the time was that Mr. Goldman had previously been suspended, or I think they had heard that he had previously been suspended. That suspension was now over, did not know that he would ultimately be disbarred, did not know that he closed his office or any of those things. On the injunction, the original judgment did a little bit more than just resolve the assignment issue. So paragraph 5 of the original judgment, this is at pages 36 and 37, says, upon execution of this judgment. Well, let me pause there and say, after the trial and after the findings of fact and conclusions of law, CEC continued to harass High Desert about these alleged modifications and unpermitted work from 2019. So we're now in...
Does that make the judgment ineffectual?
Well, I don't know about that, but let me explain this for a moment if I can, Your Honor, which is we're in like late 2022, early 2023 before judgment is entered. And so High Desert files an application for an order to show cause before entry of the original 2023 judgment. And paragraph 5 says that a bunch of these notices of breach of lease from 2000, I think that's a typo. I think that should be 2022, December 2022. And here's the key line, are declared to be invalid for the reasons set forth in plaintiff's November 3rd and December 9th, 2022 applications for order to show cause. That is in the original 2023 judgment. That judgment was appealed from. This court affirmed it. This was not raised as an issue in the appeal. So the notion that this judgment found invalid these claims of unpermitted work and construction issues from 2019, those were found invalid in the original judgment, not overturned on the appeal. That finding is now law of the case. And where we are now is we're not on a direct appeal from that 2023 judgment. We're not on a direct appeal from even the injunction that's being challenged now. We're here only on a Rule 60 motion. I think the
basic... Does 60B6 apply if I... And I'm not saying I do, if I think the follow-on judgment is overly broad?
No, because that's something that needed to be raised under 60B1, and Rule 60B6 is mutually exclusive with the grounds that can be raised under Rule 60B1. So 60B6 is an extraordinary kind of catch-all that that is used very sparingly. I think it's the way this appeal played out is a little odd, because the grounds on which CEC has moved... It's alleged to have moved, shifted, I think, between the opening brief, the reply brief, and now at argument. So in the opening brief, there were arguments about 60B3. Those were largely abandoned by the time of the reply. The reply focused on 60B4, which, as you noted, applies only when the judgment is void for lack of personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction for the most part. And now at oral argument, I think he's mostly abandoning the 60B4 argument, is shifting to a 60B6 argument, but that fails because that's mutually exclusive with the other 5 provisions in the rule.
So did the court err in relying on 60B6 to modify the prior judgment?
It probably did.
We
did not cross appeal on this because the court granted relief that we think clarified the original intent of the injunction, which nobody intended this injunction to preclude, for example, recovering attorney's fees under the lease or covering items that existed after the 2023 judgment, so we didn't cross appeal. So even if the court erred on Rule 60B6, that's not before this court. So just to quickly cover the bases.
But doesn't the fact that 60B6 applies, isn't that law of the case now? Maybe not because we're the Court of Appeals and that's the Superior Court, but...
No, that's not law of the case because obviously for that exact reason, what the Superior Court did doesn't bind this court. We don't have an obligation to appeal a ruling that we're not challenging. And the court, and maybe if, for example, just to play this out for a moment, if you affirmed here, then it would be law of the case that Rule 60B6 applied only to the particular modifications that the Superior Court ordered, but it wouldn't apply to the other bases that CEC is appealing on now, because the court didn't grant Rule 60B6 relief as to those. So it's not law of the case that Rule 60B6 applies to those bases that it's asserting now. Some of those bases weren't...
Before you, what subsection of 1801... I mean, I'll admit, I've never seen an injunction like this. It's new to me. What subsection of 1801 are we looking at here?
It is...
And I'll tell you, I'll walk through them. One,
right,
seems to me to incorporate probably the four traditional requirements to obtain injunctive relief. Two is doing something to stop a party from making the judgment ineffectual. Not exactly how sure how broad that is or not. I mean, I think the traditional limit would, or the traditional power would be someone is moving money left and right to avoid a judgment. The court can lock down the assets to make sure there's something there for the party who won. I also think the court could probably issue a judgment that incorporates claim preclusion principles to stop a party from filing follow-on lawsuits over and over again. But I'm just not sure, based on this language, how much broader the authority is than those types of things. And three, in all other cases, when applicant is entitled to an injunction under the principles of equity. I mean, I looked at this statute, was originally drafted in 1901. So are we looking at equity principles that existed in 1901, just like the Supreme Court does with the Judiciary Act of 1789? It looks at what equitable principles existed at Westminster. So what are your thoughts on, I know that's a long question, one might call it a speech, but
sure.
Where are we within the statute and what is the standard that we're applying here?
So I bet you could predict what I'm going to say. So it is subsections 1 and 3 that the court, I think, was relying on. Those are arguments that are not being raised by CEC. CEC has not contended, for example, that subsection 3 is limited to principles of equity at the time the statute was adopted.
Do you have any historical analog, something like this, that at least an Arizona appellate court has approved?
I don't, but the question before this court is not whether the Superior Court should have issued this injunction in the first place. The question before this court is limited to whether this kind of collateral attack is justified under Rule 60, where somebody comes in 8 months after the judgment was entered and tries to attack this. These may have been very good arguments to raise in a direct appeal from the injunction. We don't have that. Obviously, that deadline expired long ago. This is an appeal solely from the Rule 60 ruling that granted in part and denied in part the Rule 60 motion. So these principles about whether this injunction complied with 12-1801, that's a collateral attack on the judgment itself, on the injunction itself. That's not proper under Rule 60b-4 or 60b-6, and obviously 1 through 3 are time barred now.
So let's say we think it's proper under 60b-6. So then we're looking at, did the court err in the scope of the injunction? You're saying it's 1 or 3.
Yes.
I didn't see the court walk through the 4 requirements for injunctive relief.
That's correct.
And I didn't see the court do any analysis under the principles of equity. So why would we not at least vacate and remand for the court to maybe be a little more nuanced in its ruling?
I think you could, again, if this were a direct appeal. And I understand I'm trying to accept your premise that this is proper under Rule 60b-6. That may be the proper remedy if this is a valid 60b-6 argument. I think for purposes of that discussion, I'd largely rest on both our argument that 60b-6 is not appropriate here and was not raised as the basis for this injunction authority argument, either below in the Superior Court in the Rule 60 motion or on appeal in the opening or reply briefs. The reply brief almost essentially abandons everything except 60b-4. So I don't think that this court should issue a decision that would encourage parties in the future to raise collateral attacks in an appeal from a Rule 60 motion that was filed 8 months after the original judgment. I think that would create very bad incentives.
So humor me. One and three. How does this injunction satisfy 1 or 3?
So I don't think that this court has ever ruled that to fall within 1801(3), the court has to make explicit findings on the record about the traditional equity factors. This court on an appeal will infer any findings that are necessary to support the judgment. And so I think those 4 factors are things that you can and ought to infer from the ruling here. The other thing I'd like to focus on in this injunction authority argument is if you look at what are the particular challenges that CEC is raising under this issue, there are essentially 2 types of challenges that they're raising. One is the scope of the injunction because it allegedly covers things that occurred after the judgment and barred seeking attorney's fees under Section 33, allegedly. And the other one is that it's void against public policy under 1802 subsection 4. Those are the 2 challenges that CEC is really making under this injunction authority argument, and both of those fail on their own. The clarification order resolved the timing issue and the attorney's fees issue. And so I'm really struggling to understand what CEC wants this court to do on that issue. Again, this is an appeal not from the original judgment, but from this Rule 60 motion. The Rule 60 motion was granted in these two respects. It was granted and clarified that the injunction does not cover things that occurred before the judgment. It was granted to clarify that it does not preclude seeking fees under Section 33 of the lease. So I don't know what CEC wants this court to do, to remand for the court to do exactly what it already did, which is to grant Rule 60 relief on that front.
Let's say there was some sort of latent defect that existed prior to the original judgment, but is only discovered later and could not have been discovered beforehand. Is under your reading of the follow-on injunction, is CEC prohibited from going to the building inspector and saying, we've discovered this latent issue and something, we're just reporting it, we don't know much about it because this is High Desert's fault?
So I don't think that the injunction would actually prohibit that particular activity under the text of the injunction. And CEC, I gave some thought to this about, what if you have those kind of latent issues that weren't, that couldn't be known at the time of the injunction? Again, that's not an argument that CEC raised either in the Superior Court or in this court. So I don't think you should reverse the judgment on an argument that wasn't presented to either court.
Well, just to humor us, can you expand upon why you think Judge Catlett's example wouldn't violate? I mean, G says, claiming there is any current or prior issue concerning any building safety or building code rule, regulation, ordinance, or law violation caused by plaintiffs or any of them.
So I think CEC can report a potential issue to a regulator, for example, without affirmatively asserting that there is a safety or building code violation. It can report a condition. The injunction does not prohibit reporting a condition, and the regulator, of course, can then investigate that condition and make its own determination about whether the condition results in a violation. So the injunction is narrower than I think it's being portrayed as.
And G doesn't even say that it has to be High Desert who violated. It just says claiming that there's any current or prior issue concerning any building safety or building code rule.
Right.
So could they go, under G, can they go to the building inspector and say, we violated, there's this issue and we violated? They couldn't, right?
I don't know. That's a good question. This is what happens when a lawyer essentially abandons his client, right? These are all issues that could have been raised before the injunction was issued in the first place.
I also think counsel submitting the proposed form of judgment has an obligation to think these things through and make sure that the injunction is narrowly tailored.
He does, Your Honor. But the question now is, what do you do if the court entered an injunction and 8 months pass and then someone comes in and seeks to change it? I don't think this court ought to issue a ruling that would encourage other litigants to come into court 8 months later and launch a collateral attack on the scope of an injunction. I don't think there's any dispute, or maybe there is a dispute, but a court can issue an injunction like this if the evidence supported it. And so it doesn't fall under Rule 60b-4 for voidness. It doesn't fall under the Rule 60b-6 catch-all. And so these are issues that could have been raised either in opposition to the application for an order to show cause in the Superior Court in 2023, I think, or in a timely Rule 60b-1 motion, but they can't be raised now. And I mean,
at the time they filed the Rule 60 motion and they attach the new documents from regulators, didn't they violated this injunction before it had been clarified, right?
I don't know whether the evidence supports
that. They claimed there were current or prior issues concerning any building safety or building code rule.
Perhaps they did, but there were no contempt proceedings brought against CEC for that. And I think that's key here. So, for example, on the issues relating to the scope of time that the injunction covered and the attorney's fees, CEC claims in its brief that it had to live under this injunction for however long, 15 months, but there were no contempt proceedings against CEC. The injunction was never enforced against CEC on those terms, and the injunction has never been enforced against CEC for the types of hypotheticals you're raising now. And again, those may have been valid issues to raise in opposition to the application for an order to show cause in the Superior Court or in a Rule 60b-1 motion or in a direct appeal from the injunction. And I take your points on all of those. Maybe this injunction could have been issued more narrowly and that would have resolved some of the issues. But the fact that it was issued and then 8 months passed, that's where we are today.
Doesn't this injunction broaden the injunction that was in the original judgment?
I don't think it broadens the injunction. I think this is designed to enforce the injunction. And I think, especially if you think about the sequence of events that led up to this, if you look at the application for order to show cause and the court's findings in the order granting relief, the principal motivation for this injunction was to get CEC to sign the assignment that the Superior Court ordered it to sign, but it refused to sign. So that's what was motivating all of this leading up to the injunction. We're focusing on what is on subparagraph G, which is like the seventh letter in the alphabet, and comes after the key provision, which is sign the assignment that the court ordered you to sign. And so, again, if Mr. Goldman had not essentially abandoned his client, then these are issues that he could have raised before the injunction got issued. CEC's remedy in this case is not with High Desert. It's not with this court on a Rule 60 motion. The remedy is with its own attorney, with Mr. Goldman, who apparently closed his office without telling his clients, without telling opposing counsel, without telling the court. He had filed an appearance in the case. Even though he was suspended for less than 30 days, he never withdrew. He was not obligated to withdraw. He was not obligated to re-engage with his client. And so from High Desert's perspective, he continued to serve as CEC's counsel. And so High Desert served him. And that complies with due process, complies with Rule 5. Again, courts generally don't impose the extreme burdens and intrusiveness of Rule 4 service of process. Where you have to send a process server to someone's home or something like that and serve them personally.
I mean, most of the basis, at least for G in the follow-on injunction, I think was correspondence that CEC was sending to High Desert.
Correct.
So how was High Desert suffering irreparable harm from those correspondence?
Well, number one,
High Desert knew they were frivolous or didn't have any basis.
So if you look at the volume of communications, I just wrote down the dates. So after the February 2023 judgment was entered, which again, paragraph 5 of that judgment said that the prior notices of breach were invalid for the reasons in the OSC application. After that judgment was entered, CEC sent letters, emails, and phone calls to Trulieve's CEO and attorney, and on April 26th, April 28th, July 25th, August 17th, November 30th, December 6th, December 13th, December 27th, January 4th, January 30th. That's what led to this application for an order to show cause. CEC was harassing its...
And so the irreparable harm is what, having to read letters and emails that you know are unsupported?
Having to suffer this harassment and interference with its business. And again, that kind of irreparable harm argument may have been proper in a direct appeal or in opposition to the application for an order to show cause, but it's not a valid basis under 12b-4 or 12b-6. So I take the court's criticisms of the injunction, and I think if you three are on the bench looking at this order to show cause, you may have narrowed the injunction before entering it, but that's not where we are now. We're on a collateral attack on a Rule 60 motion, and the grounds for doing so 8 months after the judgment are very narrow. Be happy to answer any other questions. Otherwise, we ask that you affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would like to point out that High Desert actually did move for sanctions and an application for show cause for violating that injunction.
Right.
So that's to the point that they are using it and to the point that they are stopping them from claiming anything that happened to the code enforcement prior to that 2023. And there are many issues that arose after the fact, and there's also subsequent litigation going on between the parties to this day in another case regarding those issues.
So I think you should focus on why you think 60B6 is applicable here.
Because it goes to the extraordinary relief here that what it's done to CEC to essentially make the lease unenforceable, everything that they've done prior to anything that's happened prior to 2023, CEC cannot do anything about. based on how the injunction is written. It cannot enforce it. It cannot claim it. There could be major issues with the building, which had been alleged, and they're prohibited from doing anything about it. They can't claim any issues were done prior to 23. That is, to me, the extent of extraordinary relief.
How do you respond to what was raised, that you should have directly appealed that injunction if you had concerns about its scope?
Well, this goes back to the issue, to the surface of what CEC actually knew. CEC wasn't aware of this injunction until August, more than about 5 months after the injunction was entered, the time to appeal had expired. So that's what goes back to the service issue, and it comes to the point that this is—
But isn't that an issue with prior counsel?
Well, the issue is to the point, this isn't a monetary damage that, hey, there's an X amount of dollars, I'm gonna go sue counsel for these damages for not doing it. It's an injunctive relief. How can he get any relief from formal counsel for these issues that he can no longer enforce? Is that saying, hey, any issues that are wrong for the building, I'm gonna hold my previous counsel what the repairs are? But again, is he violating the injunction by even raising that and claiming there's issues with it prior to 2023?
So is there anything in the record indicating that Mr. Goldman did not represent your client at the time that the follow-on injunction was requested?
There's a declaration from Mr. Ayers that's a part of the record in which he says he did not retain Mr. Goldman for any post-judgment representation. And he had Mr. Abney. And so that is a declaration in the record regarding that as well. So if you ask that, there is a declaration there.
Okay.
But is there actually any communication or anything attached to it? There's not.
Okay. Thank you.
And to the extent I would ask just the court to actually vacate. I'm not saying we're not challenging the part about enforcing the assignment. This is mostly what they're prohibited from doing based on that injunction.
Right.
So.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your helpful arguments and briefing in the case. We'll take the matter under advisement and get you a ruling in due course.